for naval military exercises. South Africa has a long history with Russia and a troubled one with the United States. How does this history shape the alignments of the country today, if at all?
Well, I think it is important to note. The other day I heard also the vice minister or the minister, I'm not sure, of Uganda saying similar things about Europe. And when they were under colonial rule, it was the Soviet Union that helped them, not other countries. But now we have a different situation. And I think we have to look for a peaceful world, a multipolar world, in which the rules of the United Nations will be followed. I mean, I, for one, am very much in defense. Of course, we need also a reform of the United Nations. That's very important. But we want the Charter of the United Nations and international law to be respected. So that means that we cannot condone with the invasion of Russia, whatever the motives they have. That's another question. But you have to seek your objectives in a peaceful way, in a way that privileges dialogue, privileges
we have five
conversation.
Seconds.
Sorry?
We have 5 seconds. So, Amarim, I want to thank you for being with us. We're also going to have an interview with you in Spanish and post it on our Spanish website at democracynow.org. Celso Amarim, foreign affairs advisor to Brazil's President Lula. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 2 special programming campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing to you in February and March at kboo.fm/thrills. Help us reach our goal of $17,000 by March 25th. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text us. Type in KBOO to the number 44321. For the thrill of it all, keep listening.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films throughout the month of February with a collection of films by African directors from over 16 nations.
Films will be screened at Cascade PCC, Hollywood Theater, and virtually. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
That's the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, showing Africa through African lenses, happening February 3rd until Saturday, March 4th, in celebration of Black History Month. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
KBOO is hiring a full-time web coordinator. The web coordinator maintains the front end of KBOO's website, promotes episodes, does copy editing, and helps train staff and volunteers on various website features. For the full job description and instructions for applying, please go to our website at kboo.fm/webhire23. Applications are due at midnight on Thursday, March 9th. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, climate advocates oppose an expansion of a TC Energy gas pipeline in the Northwest. Texas voter suppression efforts take aim at college students, and federal agencies have 30 days to delete TikTok from government phones. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 28th, 2023. I'm Eric Leuschner. A gas pipeline expansion project from TC Energy has been proposed in the Pacific Northwest. Opponents have sent letters to governors, including Oregon's Governor Tina Kotek, calling on them to speak out against the proposal. Eric Tegetthoff has more.
Environmental groups want West Coast governors to speak out against the expansion of a gas pipeline in the region. The Canadian company TC Energy is proposing to increase capacity for its GTN Express pipeline, which stretches more than 1,300 miles from Canada through Washington State, Oregon, and California. Meg Tennant with the group Rogue Climate in Southern Oregon says a lot of work has been done to ensure state and local governments in the Northwest pass strong climate goals to transition away from fossil fuels.
This increase in fracked gas flowing through the Northwest would fly in the face of all of that work.
Critics say expanding the pipeline would be equivalent to adding more than 750,000 cars to the roads every year for the next three decades. TC Energy says the project is necessary to meet the growing demand for gas in the Northwest as the region moves away from energy sources like coal. Oregon Senators Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden have expressed their opposition to the expansion project. Audrey Leonard with Columbia Riverkeeper says the pipeline poses safety concerns, noting TC Energy is the company behind the Keystone Pipeline system that recently leaked more than 600,000 gallons of oil in Kansas. She points out that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission never held a public hearing on the expansion project. In response, earlier this month, more than 150 opponents of the GTN Express held a people's hearing.
It's exciting to see people mobilizing and speaking out because the federal agency has really not done much to listen to those voices and also the concerns of the tribes that have been raised formally through the comment process.
Leonard says the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission could make a decision about the pipeline proposal as early as March 16th. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The U.S. government says they haven't reached a conclusion yet about where COVID-19 originated. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The president made trying to find the origins of COVID a priority right when he came into office. And he's got a whole of government effort designed to do that. There is not a consensus right now in the U.S. government about exactly how COVID started.
Despite a report from the U.S. Energy Department saying COVID-19 possibly came from a lab leak in China, the National Security Council's John Kirby said the intelligence community hasn't reached a consensus on the origins of the virus. But when there is a definitive answer, Americans will know. The United Nations is meeting to outline a climate change loss and damage fund. While the fund was established during COP27, this meeting will determine how it will operate, where the money will come from, and how it will be dispersed. While the U.S. is experiencing its own multi-billion-dollar weather events, smaller island nations like Tuvalu or the Maldives will sink in the next century due to rising sea levels. Sitash Matapa with the National Wildlife Federation describes why countries in the global south need the fund.
The hope for the Loss and Damage Fund is that it doesn't replicate previous funds and financial frameworks. It takes into account not just the economic impact, such as damage to like homes or crops.
She adds this fund also needs to take into account the mental and emotional trauma these disasters have on people. China has opposed contributing since they're viewed as a developing country by the UN. Some say China has worked hard at eliminating that label, and its climate goals should reflect that. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case that could determine the future of identity theft law. Dubin versus United States centers on whether someone is committing aggravated identity theft when they say someone else's name as they commit an offense. Some justices on the court say the vague language could result in smaller offenses becoming federal charges because they're defined as identity theft. Justice Sonia Sotomayor gave an example of how this could happen.
A parent lists their child as a dependent and lies about childcare services. There's no way to exempt that out because under the government's broad definition of the statute, because they use the child's name to commit a fraud on the government.
At the G20 summit in India, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen addressed the global economy and how current events have shaped it, and said the U.S. economy has overcome great odds.
In the United States, our economy remains resilient. Year-on-year headline inflation has moderated over the past few months, as supply chain pressures have eased and global imbalances have subsided.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The White House says federal agencies have just 30 days to delete the app TikTok from government-issued phones. They say it's because of concerns about data collection and American digital security. TikTok is owned by ByteDance, a Chinese company. Officials are concerned that the company could be sharing data it collects with the Chinese government. The U.S. government, as well as others around the world, have moved to block it from use. China says the ban reveals the United States' insecurities and are an abuse of state power. In December, Congress passed a bipartisan act called the No TikTok on Government Devices Act. It does not allow the use of TikTok in certain limited cases, like for national security. Former President Trump weighed in, proposing an all-out ban on the app, including for American consumers, and the current FCC commissioner says he welcomes it. Civil liberties organizations have pushed back, saying a ban would be unconstitutional and could lead to other businesses and applications being banned. The CEO of TikTok will testify before the House Energy and Commerce Committee in March. A Texas lawmaker wants to eliminate polling locations on the state's college campuses, citing the potential for mass shootings at academic institutions. Republican Representative Kerry Isaac filed House Bill 2390 to, quote, prohibit the designation of polling place locations on the campuses of institutions of higher education. Voting advocates say the bill is a direct attack on the perceived political power of young people. Ros Brown reports.
Texas voting advocates say a bill before the legislature to ban polling sites on college campuses for fear of mass shootings is instead a direct attack on the perceived political power of young people. Language in the bill by Republican Representative Kerry Isaac does not mention mass shootings, but since it was filed, she stated that public safety is behind the legislation. Alex Burnell with the Move Texas Action Fund says young people ages 18 to 35 are the largest electorate group in the state and calls the bill nonsensical and a targeted attack on students.
I don't expect that the bill will pass, but less relevant its passage is the idea that these types of legislation could even be entertained because this is a state where we're already ranked the most difficult place to vote.
In the last 10 years, Texas has closed a total of 750 polling locations, the most of any state. Last year, more than 400 bills were introduced in 39 states to restrict voting access, according to the Brennan Center for Justice. In Texas elections, those casting ballots can present a concealed handgun license for identification to vote, but not a student ID. Burnell says the trauma of gun violence should not be used as a reason to keep college students away from the polls.
To deploy that pain for a measure that seeks to ban polling locations on college campuses muddies the water of both issues. And on the mass shooting end, we all know that banning polling locations is not going to change that reality.
Burnell notes research that suggests voting is a habitual act, meaning those who have voted in past elections are more likely to do so again.
And the earlier one does it in life, the more likely they are to be a lifelong voter. So this is also about creating longevity in the electorate. And eliminating that site where a lot of young voters will cast their first ballot is about disturbing that longevity.
For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
A decade after dam removal, the Elwha River watershed in Washington State has rebounded. But logging on the state land threatens this habitat. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
The Elwha River watershed on the Olympic Peninsula has been transformed since dam removal a decade ago, but logging could harm the habitat's progress. Washingtonians are rallying on Sunday to protect nearby forests. The Elwha River dam removal was the largest in U.S. history to date. Elizabeth Dunn with Earth Law Center says forests in the region have come back to life, but at least six timber sales on state-managed land in the watershed contain legacy forests, or forests with many old-growth characteristics. She says the forests also are important to Port Angeles.
There's been some really strong community opposition that's growing to this logging, particularly in the Elwha River watershed, because the Elwha River supplies drinking water to the city of Port Angeles, which has about 20,000 people.
The Department of Natural Resources rejected a request from the Port Angeles City Council last year to delay a logging auction, saying the agency is required to manage state trust lands to generate revenues for public services and infrastructure. On Sunday, people are rallying near an active timber harvest site in the region to protect these forests. Opponents of logging in the region note only about 80,000 acres of legacy forest remain on state-managed lands in western Washington. Braille Froby is interim executive director of the Center for Responsible Forestry. He says legacy forests play many vital roles.
They are incredible tools to fight climate change. They sequester and store more carbon than many forests in the entire world.
Froby notes that his organization doesn't want to stop logging, but he points to Washington State's Climate Commitment Act, a law passed in 2021 aimed at helping reach the state's goal of reducing carbon emissions 95% by 2050 and with a focus on environmental justice. Froby says protecting Elwha River watershed forests through this legislation could fund communities that rely on logging.
We really want to make sure that this is a win-win and that rural communities shouldn't have to choose between sacrificing their precious ecosystems and funding things like schools.
On Sunday, rallygoers are calling on Commissioner of Public Lands Hillary Franz to stop the logging of legacy forests in the Elwha River watershed. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for the totality of circumstances with Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a potential for a slushy rain-snow mix and a low of 30 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a daytime high of 43. Today in history, in 1983, the final episode of American military comedy drama MASH aired to 106 million viewers. It is still the most watched series finale of all time. The quote of the day is from American Nobel laureate and former Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu, who said, quote, "As the saying goes, the Stone Age did not end because we ran out of stones. We transitioned to better solutions. The same opportunity lies before us with energy efficiency and clean energy." At long last, Congress has re-upped on the Federal Violence Against Women Act, but tribal groups are wondering whether they'll see needed funding. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. After a years-long battle, Congress updated and enhanced the Federal Violence Against Women Act, but many tribes are still wondering if they'll see funding for its new provisions. Matt Laszlo has a story from Washington.
Under the updated Violence Against Women Act, which President Biden signed into law last year, tribes are finally allowed to prosecute non-natives who abuse Native women in Indian country. But many tribes are asking, where's the money? Frank Starr's come out as president of the Ogallala Sioux Tribe of South Dakota.
We lack police force, law enforcement, resources on our reservation.
Yeah.
Due to a lack of funding.
So they changed the law, but they didn't give you the money to implement the law.
Well, we haven't seen anything yet, not that I know of. So.
Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren wants to change that. She's pushing the Honoring Promises to Native Nations Act. The bill has five titles aimed at what Warren says are five broken promises made by the U.S. government.
Throughout the bill, we prioritized full funding for federal Native programs. No more shortfalls. And the bill ensures that the funding going to Indian country is mandatory. Fulfilling trust and treaty obligations is not optional.
The first title, or section, of Warren's measure is focused on criminal justice and public safety, and it's mirrored off the special tribal jurisdiction included in the new Violence Against Women Act. Part of that section would fund tribal justice systems, if tribes want them. It would also increase funding for sexual assault victims in Indian country. Warren says it's long overdue.
Although this bill won't become law immediately, I think it's crucial for Congress to have legislation that says unequivocally the United States has broken its promises and the United States must start making good on them.
For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Matriarchs of the Occupation of Wounded Knee were honored as events marked the 50th anniversary. Monday marked 50 years since the beginning of a 71-day occupation of Wounded Knee on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota by members of the American Indian Movement to draw attention to broken government promises and the fight for American Indian rights. Some of the women who were there shared memories during a panel discussion over the weekend, which was live-streamed and hosted by the Warrior Women Project. Madonna Thunderhawk says she was in her 30s during that time and recalls how the event put Native issues in the spotlight.
I mean, every one of our nations was represented. And that's, again, I felt that, we're not alone. You know, it's just locally, nationally, and internationally. Because after Wounded Knee, that's what the elders told us, we've got the world's attention, we need to go further.
Thunderhawk, who says she's now an elder, has continued her advocacy, including her time at Standing Rock, opposing the Dakota Access Pipeline.
When I became an elder, I saw that was a responsibility to show up, and you don't have to say anything. You don't have to be on the mic. You just show up so those young people know you have their back.
The event honoring women was held on the Pine Ridge Reservation and provided an opportunity for story sharing and featured an oral history exhibit with Wounded Knee matriarchs. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
This is National Eating Disorders Awareness Week, and specialists are calling for more funding, education, research, and resources for those who suffer. Mark Moran speaks with the vice president of the National Eating Disorders Association to learn more.
Experts are spreading knowledge and information during National Eating Disorder Awareness Week and calling for additional education, funding, and research to combat the problem. Researchers have not been able to pin down exactly what causes eating disorders, which can range from an unhealthy relationship with food to a lethal obsession with overeating, undereating, or both, often at the same time. Lauren Smoller with the National Eating Disorders Association says this illness can show up in a variety of ways, including someone abruptly eating drastically greater or lesser amounts of food than they typically do.
It could also mean that they are not interested in eating meals with other people anymore. Drastic changes in shape or weight can be a warning sign of an eating disorder. But even cause for concern could be just changes in mood and shifts in attitudes, the way that they're talking about foods.
One thing researchers do agree on is that eating disorders are a mental illness, not a choice. And while people often assume young white females are most frequently afflicted, anorexia and bulimia nervosa, along with a host of other eating disorders, do not discriminate and are common in both genders of varying ages and ethnic groups. Smoller says the pandemic heightened awareness of eating disorders and other mental health issues, but adds that despite some progress, there is still precious little research, funding, and social acceptance of eating disorders as lethal mental illnesses, the way, say, cancer is accepted as a deadly disease.
But you can see cancer on a physical screening, whereas it's a little harder to show that an eating disorder is there in essence. There's still a lot to be learned about brain chemistry and rewiring of brains and how mental health works. And it's much more normalized to talk about it. But there's just a lot more education that needs to be done.
Smoller says because healthcare workers are not required to learn about eating disorders as part of their training, early detection is also lacking. The American Society for Nutrition reports more than 10,000 people die each year from eating disorders, the second most lethal mental illness behind only opioid addiction. For Iowa News Service, I'm Mark Moran.
Electric vehicle incentives often favor people with high incomes. But new federal tax credits could help that change. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Rebates and tax credits can make it more affordable to buy an electric vehicle. But Deborah Gorman of the Greenlining Institute says these incentives often favor higher-income people. For example, with many rebates, you have to front the money that will later be refunded.
So that actually is really conducive to more wealthier people. You can float the money, so it's not such a big deal for you. You can wait for it to come in the mail.
In a recent report, her group identified ways to make EV incentives more equitable. for example, by offering instant rebates redeemed at the time of sale and larger incentives for lower-income people.
And that's the point of equity, right? Equity isn't we all get $100. Equity is those who need $150 get that because of where they are situated in their community, and those who need $25 get $25.
She says the new Inflation Reduction Act includes federal tax credits that are intended to improve equity. For example, tax incentives will now apply to pre-owned vehicles, which low-income people are more likely to buy. But Gorman says many states still have a lot of work to do to ensure that EV incentives benefit those who need the savings most. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A U.S. Navy Rear Admiral says Americans are naive about China, and that may even include military leaders. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Are we blind about China? A few weeks ago, a rear admiral in the U.S. Office of Naval Intelligence, ONI, said that the American public was naive about China and suffers from China blindness. I'll be very honest with you, he said. It's very unsettling to see how much the U.S. is not connecting the dots on our number one challenge. It's disturbing how ill-informed and naive the average American is on China. I chalk this up, if I could summarize, into a China blindness. We face a knowledge crisis and a China blindness problem. It's hardly surprising that a Navy officer would make such a claim these days. In its official reports, the Pentagon plays up the China threat and talks about how many more ships it needs to confront the threat. To hear the Pentagon tell it, the U.S. Navy is actually behind the Chinese in ship tonnage and ship production. Don't ask a Navy officer if, therefore, he would trade the U.S. Navy for China's. Of course he wouldn't. For the simple reason that in every other respect, such as destructive power, reliability of service, and aircraft carriers, the U.S. Navy is a far greater force than the People's Liberation Army's Navy. Ask the Chinese if you don't believe it. The ONI officer is certainly correct to say that the American public isn't well informed about China. That's been true forever. But how well informed are senior U.S. officials, military and civilian? How many of them have spent quality time in China, taken courses on Chinese history and culture, spoken to people in China, or learned enough Chinese to be able to read a Chinese newspaper or article by a counterpart in the Chinese military? If the truth be told, the real problem in understanding China rests at the top, with government officials and some of their academic advisors who think they know China because of experience elsewhere. For example, from serving in war, Vietnam or some other conflict, from their reading of military history, from their understanding of international relations theory, from books on Marxism or Chairman Mao, from comparisons with the Soviet Union or Russia, from travel in Taiwan or from having a Chinese friend. I have no idea if that particular naval officer falls into one of these categories, none of which may be relevant to understanding today's China. In any case, it's interesting that the interview of him doesn't think it's relevant to mention his credentials and how he comes to his conclusions about blindness on China. What I must also point out, however obvious, is that the context for being educated about China is all important. These days, reading the mainstream media can get you into trouble. It's all about the China threat. Beijing is just years away from attacking Taiwan. China is the world's leading economic power. China and Russia have formed an aggressive alliance. You'll rarely see reference to possible reasons why America's behavior, its threats, its military alignments, its trade policies might influence China's actions, or how China's economic, social, and environmental woes may constrain rather than strengthen its foreign policy, or how insecure China's leadership actually feels because of its many internal problems. The admiral should also know how we shoot ourselves in the foot when it comes to being informed about China. Look at all the Confucius Institutes on U.S. campuses that have had to close down under threat of loss of Defense Department funds. Those institutes, wrongly accused of being Chinese spy nests, were a wonderful gift from the Chinese Education Ministry that enabled small communities around the U.S. to offer language classes and cultural events otherwise not available. Or how about the U.S. Justice Department's so-called China Initiative, which targeted visiting Chinese scientists as well as Chinese-American scientists in the wrong-headed belief they might be engaged in economic espionage on behalf of Beijing. That fear-driven and racially biased program was roundly criticized by university presidents and Congress members. The China Initiative has been dropped, but at the cost of people's reputations and the decision of some top scientists to return to China, surely with stories that debunked the notion of America's academic freedom. We can also be pretty smart about China, Admiral, even if some folks along the Beltway aren't. For example, we understand why hundreds of thousands of talented Chinese, especially in the sciences and math, want to study and do research in U.S. universities and laboratories. No, it's not in order to spy. We understand that annual large increases in the U.S. military budget don't buy security from China or anyone else. We know that unless we can work with China, we haven't a chance of stopping and reversing climate change or meeting the threats posed by nuclear weapons and pandemics. And we know that if we can't persuade this administration, this Pentagon, and this Congress to reverse course on China, we run the high risk of war. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 28th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast include Mel Gertoff. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Mark Moran, and Roz Brown. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is Totality of Circumstances, a monthly show focused on police oversight in Portland. I'm Sam Bowman. For the last year or so, we've been focusing on the work of the Police Accountability